Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Picture yourself alone in the middle of nowhere, and there's somebody following you.
He went on his way, we so thought, and then we went on ours. But in reality, he really followed us up there.
On Deadly Nightmares, the true crime podcast from ID, listen to real stories of ordinary people stalked by serial killers and attackers.
Please, tell me we're not going to die.
Listen to Deadly Nightmares on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is the true story of a newly single mother looking for love.
She liked him tall, dark, and handsome.
In all the wrong places.
Started meeting men online.
People can portray themselves as anyone. It's obvious that this guy is hiding his identity.
It's a story of secret romance.
Seemed to be a lot of sexting.
Intense jealousy.
He wanted her back. He always claimed that he loved her, that no one else would love her like he did.
And bitter revenge. Beware. Extreme passion can lead to shocking consequences. It's the summer of 2010 in the suburb of Deer Park, Washington. The kind of place where everyone knows their neighbors.
Deer Park is a little town that is 20 miles north of Spokane.
Deer Park's a good place to raise kids. Everybody knows everybody. Nothing goes unnoticed.
41-year-old Shannon Starbuck is a recent divorcee and the mother of five children.
Shannon was tall, 5'10", 5'11", blonde, beautiful, flawless skin. She reminded me almost of a old-time kind of movie star.
Since her divorce 2 months ago, Shannon has big plans.
She was attempting to better herself by going to college for dental assisting.
She was looking forward to being able to do her own thing and to earn her own money and to pay her bills.
But one person isn't thrilled about Shannon's new independence.
Hi, Clay.
Hi.
Here's your mail. It's still coming here.
Her ex-husband, Clay.
Clay's a handsome guy, and he's tall, dark-haired.
Kind of a frontiersy guy, beard, kind of gruff looking. He was charismatic. He was a family man.
I'm sorry.
Shannon and Clay first met in their early 20s.
It's okay.
Clay was immediately drawn to the beautiful Mormon church girl.
Shannon and Clay met at a church dance in southern Florida.
You're picking up the kids from school today, right?
Of course.
Okay, great.
Clay was what she preferred to date. Like that look, that type of big and tall.
I'm gonna get back to it, but have a good day.
You too.
Okay, bye.
But in the decades that followed, trouble in their marriage led the couple to divorce. Not once, but twice.
She thought it would be better for the kids for them to be divorced, that it was just not a good environment when they were together.
In spite of their rocky relationship, Clay still hopes for a reconciliation.
He wanted her back. He always claimed that he loved her, that no one else would love her like he did.
But Shannon clearly doesn't share his feelings. And that summer, she decides to start dating.
I had tried to set her up a couple times, and she'd look at pictures, and she was picky. She was picky about who she wanted to go out with. She said, well, it's so hard to meet people, and I said, why don't you try online dating?
Curious about whom she might find, Shannon sets up a profile page.
Shannon's profile basically laid out, you know, who she was, what she was like, and most importantly, what she was looking for in her life.
She wanted to be able to carry on a conversation with someone that was intelligent and deep.
Everything that Clay is not. In September of 2011, Shannon gets a message from a man named John Wilson. He appears to fulfill all of her physical requirements. Tall, handsome, with what he describes as an athletic body. Shannon responds enthusiastically.
Shannon told John about her family and her lifestyle, the fact that she was divorced and that she had 5 kids.
But John is more secretive.
He gives her limited information. He tells her that he is a caretaker for an elderly couple that live in North Spokane and that he's a substitute teacher.
Yet there is one point John makes perfectly clear.
He's very upfront with anybody who happens to stumble on this. He says, hey, I'm looking for fun.
In other words, John isn't in the market for a serious relationship. A few days later, John agrees to meet Shannon at her house while her kids are at school.
She was hesitant to be seen outside of the residence with any guy.
She's like, I don't want anybody meeting my kids. And she wanted to really keep it very quiet that she was dating at all.
Hi.
Hi. Shannon.
Hi.
Pleasure to meet you.
Oh, gosh. It's nice to meet you.
When John and Shannon first meet, John is really kind of surprised at how beautiful Shannon is. She's probably more than he expected from his online experience.
I'll put these in some water. And
Shannon is equally impressed by John. But there's one problem. John is not the same man who appears in his profile picture. And strangely, Shannon doesn't say anything about it.
Shannon either doesn't notice or is willfully ignorant. She wants to get to know this guy.
Come on.
For the next few hours, Shannon and John get acquainted by the couch.
Here is your tea.
They engage in just idle chit-chat at first, play a board game of Scrabble.
All right.
Shannon is immediately attracted to John, and in no small part because he is very different from her ex-husband, Clay. He treats her like a woman, and he's capable of having intellectual conversations.
Pretty soon, their seemingly innocent board game leads to something more.
As this kind of get-to-know-one-another board game continues, it's a kind of an intimate setting, and a little flirting breaks out.
And while they're busy playing, they lean over and start kissing.
And before they know it, Shannon and John are upstairs, in broad daylight, in the bed she once shared with her ex.
Right from the start, this couple is very passionate. Shannon's along for the ride.
Taking John into the bedroom is a big step for Shannon, and this is symbolically a major way for her to step away from her marriage.
Hidden away from the gaze of her small town, Shannon is finally free to enjoy her single life.
This is one dirty little secret for Shannon.
But who is this mysterious man with the false profile picture? Shannon's online dating adventures are about to lead her on an erotic trip beyond her wildest fantasies and into a dangerous world of smoke and mirrors where no one can be trusted. It's 2011 in Deer Park, Washington, and Shannon Starbuck, a recent divorcee, is indulging in a passionate sexual relationship with a man she met online. And it's all happening while her children are at school. For now, it's Shannon's secret. Her family and friends have no idea what's going on behind closed doors.
This is a small town, and if she's seen out in the public somewhere with somebody people don't connect her with, man, the small town tongues are wagging.
But despite Shannon's efforts to keep a low profile, that fall, rumors of her dating reach her ex-husband, Clay.
Yeah, what's up? Really?
What did he look like?
Through the kids, Clay learns that Shannon is now dating, and she's meeting guys through the internet. Not what he really wants to hear. He's a very protective person of his family.
Did they go back to the house?
He's thinking, you know, are strangers coming to the house? Where are they meeting? Where are they spending time? What do the kids know about it?
His concern seemed to be, who were these people? Who was around my kids?
Clay knows that Shannon won't take kindly to his concern about her social life.
He doesn't really want to confront Shannon. To take a step back and use other resources to find out what was going on seemed to him to be the best idea.
So Clay begins quietly, keeping an eye on things. But Shannon quickly catches on.
When Shannon finds Clay outside the house, she's not happy.
She felt that maybe he might have been invading her privacy a little bit.
Not only did this interfere with her newfound independence, but it reminded her of all the reasons she wanted out of the marriage.
Fed up, Shannon decides to put her foot down.
And Shannon does what she thinks she has to do under the circumstances.
He keeps coming by. Honestly, I don't feel comfortable anymore. I think maybe we should look into a restraining order.
This restraining order that Shannon got prohibits Clay from doing anything to contact her but texting. No phone calls, no visits, just texts.
I'm not sure what else to do.
Breaking free from Clay gives Shannon a thrilling sense of freedom and empowerment. And soon, she finds herself spending more time with her private online lover, John.
Shannon and John continue to see one another. Now it's almost a weekly thing. For Shannon, this was such a tremendous change. John is the kind of guy who's making her feel like a beautiful woman.
I really gotta get going.
One afternoon, Shannon tells John she's ready to take what they have to the next level.
Shannon began to want more from the relationship.
For Shannon, like most women, the hot sex develops into an emotional bond. For her, emotions and sex are inextricably linked.
But John's reaction is not what she'd hoped for.
Look, I told you in the profile, I'm just looking to have some fun. Let's not ruin this, okay?
He tells her, look, I told you this was fun from the start. It's still just fun. I understand if you want more than that, and we'll just end this.
But does this lover boy just want to have fun? Or is he hiding dangerous secrets? Although spurned by his refusal to make things more serious, Shannon isn't ready to give John up yet. But she also decides to go back online to expand her horizons.
As Shannon continues her search efforts, she does see a guy here and a guy there that at least is interesting enough to go out with. But after these dates, nothing's clicking.
Then one day, she gets a message from a man named Tom.
Tom, he's athletic, he seems to be fit, intelligent. It looks like this guy might fit the bill.
Shannon sends him a message suggesting they meet in person. It's a big step, but with her divorce now far behind her, she's ready to date in the open.
Shannon approaches the prospect of meeting Tom differently this time. She wants to meet Tom in public.
On November 7th, Shannon and Tom meet at a nearby restaurant.
Hi, are you Shannon?
Hi, Tom?
Yes.
When Tom meets Shannon, he had to be pretty impressed. This is an attractive woman. This woman is a catch. When Shannon meets Tom, he's actually the guy whose picture is in the profile online. This is a good sign for her. He's honest. He's open with her. Talks about his life. And they do hit it off.
The two set up a date to see each other again. But almost immediately, the anticipation starts to build.
In this time between their lunch and this planned date a few weeks down the road, both Shannon and Tom are anxious to get to know one another.
Then one day, Shannon gets a suggestive text from Tom. And her imagination runs wild.
Their messages get increasingly explicit.
They're sharing ideas and ultimately pictures.
Before long, Shannon and Tom are regularly exchanging sexually charged messages.
Tom and Shannon are obviously starting to fantasize about one another, and the texts reflect that.
For now, Shannon is having the time of her life with her various suitors. But as the winter approaches, not everything in Shannon's life is going as well as her romantic endeavors.
Shannon hadn't found that job as a dental assistant yet, and Clay wasn't working, so that financial resource was gone. It was a tough time.
Nobody knew how bad off Shannon was. When I found out, I was horrified. She had almost been evicted a couple of times. She had her power shut off. Her car had been repoed.
Shannon's friend comes to her rescue.
Hi, Summer.
I said, why don't you borrow my pickup? Then you at least can go to the grocery store. You can take the kids wherever they need to go.
You sure?
Shannon takes Summer up on the offer. But a few days later, when she goes out to the truck, Shannon makes a disturbing discovery.
She called me one day and said, I'm really sorry. I'm really sorry. I said, what happened? She said, all the windows have been shot out of the truck. And I went, oh, no.
Shannon is shaken to the core. Then, over the course of that month, Shannon begins to notice other strange occurrences, this time inside her home.
She would feel like she had guns stolen, jewelry stolen, or she would go in and feel like somebody had been there. Just, you know, when you go into your home and it doesn't feel right.
And as the days pass, Shannon becomes convinced that someone is watching her.
Shannon would always call her mom and say, Mom, there's something going on.
She was telling me what was going on with the breaking into the house and stealing the jewelry and moving things around in the house. And that would creep me out.
Is someone trying to send Shannon a threatening message? She decides to take precautions.
And she changes the locks at the house.
Could it be her overprotective ex-husband, Clay? Her lover, John, who's determined to protect his privacy? Or her new flirt, Tom, who may not be the nice guy she thinks he is? On the afternoon of December 1st, Shannon is scheduled to pick her daughter up from school. But by 3 o'clock, Shannon still hasn't arrived.
The kids are wondering where their mom is, and so the kids are texting her, trying to get in touch with her.
Finally, they get a response.
She texts her daughter and says, I'm not feeling well. Your brother is going to pick you up.
He picks up his sister and the children go to Clay's house. But later that night, no one can get a hold of Shannon again.
It's like she's disappeared.
For months, Shannon Starbuck has been leading a secret life that no one knows about except her male suitors. But her world is about to be exposed in the most horrific and scandalous way imaginable. Shannon Starbuck, a divorced mother of five in Deer Park, Washington, is missing.
Nobody had any idea where she was. And in a small town like Deer Park, that was very alarming.
On December 2nd, Shannon's ex-husband, Clay, calls the police. He says the last anyone heard from Shannon was around 3 p.m. the previous day when she texted their daughter to say she wasn't feeling well.
Spokane County Sheriff's Department went to Shannon's home, knocked on the door, didn't see any sort of strange activity around her home, didn't see any broken windows, didn't see anything that made it seem like there was something suspicious going on.
The deputy tells Clay that there isn't anything he can do at that point in time.
By the next day, Shannon has been missing for close to 48 hours. Her mother is frantic.
It had been a few days since I had heard from Shannon, which was very unusual because we always talked and text. She always answered. I wanted someone to get out and check on my daughter.
The Spokane County Sheriff's Department decides to check on Shannon again, but this time they gain access to the house. And when the officers enter the master bedroom, they find a horrific scene. It's Shannon, and she's dead.
They discover Shannon's body. She's got bruising to her arm. Her chest area has injuries consistent with a struggle. She's got marks around her neck that would appear consistent with strangulation.
But that's not all. Shannon's body appears to have been posed in a most disturbing way.
Somebody put her like this.
She's lying on the bed with her clothing pulled back, leaving her exposed. And there is a sexual device inserted inside her. The investigators begin the grim task of processing the scene.
The assailant most likely touched the victim on the neck, on the wrists, and so the medical examiner takes some swabs for DNA testing.
They also search the house to determine how the killer got in, but find no signs of forced entry.
What this tells me is that whoever committed this crime accessed the house at a moment of opportunity when the doors and windows is unlocked, or that the victim knew the assailant and allowed them in of their own free will.
The violation of Shannon's body and the lack of forced entry lead investigators to one conclusion.
She knew them. She let them in.
In most situations where a person is posed, it's a personal vendetta type crime. It means something to the person who has done it.
Later that day, Shannon's family and friends get the terrible news.
It was dark out, and I opened the door and I saw my son and my daughter, and I knew that she was gone, and that's what my son said. She's gone, Mom, she's gone.
It just made me physically ill. We're told by detectives it's an ugly crime scene. She was a mess.
An hour later, Clay arrives at Shannon's house.
Clay was completely surprised by everything that was taking place. He saw major crimes and was all upset, like, what's going on? Why is major crimes here? He was informed that Shannon was deceased, and he collapses to his knees.
But the detectives refused to tell him how Shannon died or let him near the crime scene. Instead, they ask Clay to go to the police station.
Sir, we need you to go down to Station B on 14th Street and give him a formal statement.
As her ex-husband, he's considered a person of interest.
There had been a little bit of suspicion kind of swirling around that maybe Clay did it, that they need to look at Clay as the suspect.
At the station, investigators asked Clay about the last time he spoke with Shannon.
He told us that he had texted Shannon the morning of December 1st, 2011, telling her that his car broke down and that she needed to take the kids to school.
Shannon dropped the children off, and he claims to have spent the day trying to fix his car. Then, around 3 p.m., Clay says their daughter received a final text from Shannon.
She sent me a text telling me that she couldn't pick the kids up.
It was the last anyone heard from her. For now, Clay is still considered a person of interest, but with no information to contradict his story, he's free to go. But surprisingly, Clay stays put and has a lot more to say.
When the interview was over, Clay wouldn't leave. He stuck around and wanted to provide more information and seemed adamant that everything we needed to know was going to be found on her cell phones and her computers.
And he kept telling detectives, you look at the online things that she had been doing, you look through the phone records, that will tell you everything that you need to know. He kept reiterating that point.
Meanwhile, detectives have begun to do just that. They scour Shannon's cell phone, which was found just a few feet from her body.
Shannon's phone was key to the investigation for the police. This device was the last way that anybody had any contact with Shannon when she was alive.
Several numbers show up on her phone from her friends, family, and a mystery man.
You've got a lot of text messages and call from this guy named Tom.
One message in particular stands out. It was sent to Shannon on the day she died.
Tom had a sexual exchange by text message about what he would like, and he would like to see a photograph of her in a sexually explicit manner.
He sent her a text message to pose provocatively. That's how we found the body, right?
Mm-hmm. The pose that is asked for is the exact same pose Shannon's body is found in on the bed.
It's an astonishing discovery. Could this Tom be the one who killed Shannon and then positioned her? The case has gone into overdrive, and it's only the beginning. Will Shannon's secret love life lead police straight to the truth behind this gruesome murder?
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Picture yourself alone in the middle of nowhere, and there's somebody following you.
He went on his way, we so thought, and then we went on ours. But in reality, he really followed us up there.
On Deadly Nightmares, the true crime podcast from ID, listen to real stories of ordinary people stalked by serial killers and attackers.
Please, tell me we're not going to die.
Listen to Deadly Nightmares on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Police in Spokane, Washington, are investigating the case of 42-year-old Shannon Starbuck, who was murdered and then positioned in a humiliating pose on her bed. A few hours into the investigation, detectives get their first lead. They uncover a text message on Shannon's cell phone from a man who asked Shannon to pose in exactly the same way she was found dead.
Let's give that guy a buzz, bring him in.
Tracking down Tom was very easy because his phone number was right there in Shannon's phone.
Yeah, hi, Tom. This is Spokane Police Department.
The investigators asked Tom to come in for questioning.
I revealed to him that this was a homicide investigation, and he seemed very surprised by the fact.
Detectives asked Tom about the provocative text found on Shannon's cell phone.
Now, you sent her a text message to pose sexually. Is that correct?
Yes, we have been...
He says they only met once, but had been sexting for weeks in anticipation of their next date, up until the day she died.
He admitted that he had talked to her and that he had asked her for the picture, but strongly denies that he ever had any involvement in her murder.
I had nothing to do with this murder.
Next, Tom is asked where he was on the day Shannon was murdered. Since the medical examiner was unable to establish a specific time of death, investigators believe she was killed sometime after the last text message was sent from her phone at around 3 p.m.
And he's able to lay out a pretty decent timeline of the places where he's been, specifically on December 1st.
I had a work conference.
So if we check on that, they will vouch for you.
Yes, please check.
All right, we will.
But still, without an exact time of death, Tom remains a strong suspect. It's now been weeks since Shannon was killed. Detectives go back to Shannon's cell phone for more clues and land on yet another suspicious series of texts.
In going through Shannon's text messages, we find these exchanges from an email account under the title of Just Wondering 06.
And Just Wondering 06 had plans to meet Shannon.
We realized that they had an encounter that was scheduled for December 1st.
The day she died.
We don't know who this person is. We don't have a phone number to associate him with, and we have to go searching. And we get a hit for a man by the name of John Wilson.
It turns out this John Wilson isn't as easily contacted as Tom. Investigators trace his calls only to learn he's been contacting Shannon from a public computer and phone at a local library.
So the calls from a payphone is a very big red flag because of the fact that this person now appears like they've got something to hide. He does not want to be found.
Investigators try sending a message to John's username and wait for a response.
I identified myself as being with the sheriff's office. It took very little time, about 20 minutes, and he gave me a call.
At first, John is cagey.
Told me that he, in fact, was not John Wilson. He didn't want to identify who he was.
So detectives are forced to change strategies. They tell John that they have a picture of him taken from surveillance video at the public payphone. And if he doesn't come forward, they'll go public with a photo.
At that point, he realized that he would be identified because he was a rather well-known person to a number of people here in town.
John agrees to come in for questioning, and the investigators finally learn what he's been hiding.
And then he opens up and says, okay, I'll tell you who I am.
I got a wife. I got a family, all right?
He is a school teacher in Spokane. He has a lot to lose if anyone catches him having an affair with another woman. So he went to great lengths to hide who he was.
For months, John had been dating under an online profile with a fake name and photos. And all the while, Shannon never knew he was married with children. It's a huge revelation, but there's more. John admits he had been to Shannon's house on the day she died. Not once, not twice, but at least three times. With his last visit at 10:30 p.m., hours after the final text was sent from Shannon's phone.
He travels up to Deer Park and he makes these multiple attempts to contact Shannon and is unable to do so.
He went around the house. He looked around in the windows. I mean, he was knocking on the door numerous times. He went back again.
There are three opportunities here that he could have killed her during any one of these.
John agrees to provide a DNA sample, but the detectives remain suspicious.
We both walked away at that time with this eerie feeling about John that this guy could still be our suspect.
3 weeks after Shannon's death, the investigation reaches a standstill. There are three persons of interest: Shannon's ex-husband Clay, and Tom and John, the two men she was dating online.
But there was no timestamp on the murder. There was nothing to say she died at this specific time. So it couldn't rule this person out. It couldn't rule that person out.
Then there's a break in the case. Detectives receive records from the cell phone company and notice one number that, for safety reasons, didn't appear on Shannon's actual phone.
I'm going through her cell phone records, and on the top line of a sheet is a 911 call. And I can remember standing up at my desk going, oh my God, she called 911. It was an incredible moment.
The call was placed at 9:18 a.m., and police are convinced they're listening to a recording of Shannon's final moments.
In playback, you can hear a distinct noise that sounds like potentially a struggle. Someone definitely in distress is what you can hear.
Based on this new information, the investigators now believe Shannon died around 9:18, the morning of December 1st. And any messages sent from her phone after that time could only have been sent by one person, the killer. The hunt is on for the man who murdered Shannon Starbuck. And when it's all over, forensic evidence and a seemingly innocent video will expose the lies and motives of a deranged monster. For the past few weeks, the Spokane County Sheriff's Office has been investigating the murder of divorcee Shannon Starbuck. They now believe Shannon called 911 moments before she was killed, estimating the time of death after 9:18 a.m. on December 1st, 2011. Detectives returned to the initial suspects to trace their movements during this earlier time frame. Tom, who asked Shannon to send him a salacious photo that day, said he was nowhere near Shannon's home.
We're able to see through Tom's phone that his cell phone doesn't appear to ever be in the Deer Park area, so we are able at that point then to exclude him as a possible suspect.
But their most promising suspect, John, admitted he stopped by Shannon's house at least three times that day. And lo and behold, he also claims to have an alibi for where he was at 9:18 that morning.
I was getting coffee.
He bought a coffee about the same time that Shannon was murdered, and there was no way that he could have bought the coffee and got to Deer Park and got that coffee at the same time.
You guys can check it out, Spokane Coffee Shop.
And luckily for him, he orders an unusual coffee.
Caramel latte, check the receipts.
Okay, if that checks out, then we're good.
And the barista there is able to confirm this by his unusual coffee order, and he's got the receipt to prove it.
John is ruled out as a suspect. That leaves one person. Is it possible that Clay, Shannon's ex-husband, and the father of their five children, could have been responsible for this heinous crime?
So the investigators circle back. They look specifically at Clay's story.
Clay told police that his car broke down that morning, and he spent the rest of the day trying to fix it.
He said he walked on that street four times at least, going back and forth between the broken down vehicle and his house.
When investigators retrace Clay's steps, they find a home with a security camera pointing towards the road. The footage reveals something unexpected.
Not once on there do we ever see Clay Starbuck pass by the house, which he was very adamant to us he had passed by numerous times that day. When we saw the video, there was no mistaking that he hadn't told us the truth.
But that's not all. In early 2012, nearly 2 months after Shannon was killed, the DNA results are in.
I received a laboratory report that indicated that the DNA was analyzed, and they were the samples taken from Shannon's neck and facial area around her mouth and from her nails, her right hand nails, and that DNA was consistent with being DNA from Clay Starbuck or any of his male children.
But Clay and Shannon's two sons both had solid alibis.
It's Detective Marichek at the Spokane Police Department.
So they reach out to the school, confirm that indeed the 17-year-old was there and the 20-year-old was at work. The cops then felt comfortable in ruling them out,
leaving just one possible killer.
Thank you.
Clay. On February 6th, Clay is arrested and charged with aggravated murder and sexually violating human remains.
We went up to Deer Park and we picked Clay up and had him transported.
Investigators are now confident they know what happened to Shannon Starbuck. In the weeks leading up to the murder, Clay had grown increasingly jealous.
He could not stand Shannon moving on with her life without him.
The morning of December 1st, 2011, Clay asked Shannon to drive the children to school on the pretense that his car broke down. While she was gone, Clay went to her house to wait for her return.
He waited for his opportunity, and when he saw it, he went for it.
Clay, what the hell are you doing here?
I'm sick of you.
As Clay attempted to subdue Shannon with a taser, she fought back.
She gets her phone, dials 911.
But the dispatcher didn't hear Shannon and believed the call was accidental.
She was then beaten, more or less tortured. After he has killed her, does two things. He goes into a mode of positioning her to make her look like she's some kind of a loose woman.
I believe that he killed her and he posed her after looking at text from Tom to mimic what Tom had asked her to pose like.
Nobody deserves to die like Shannon died.
And finally, Clay sent messages from Shannon's phone throughout the day and laid it near her body in a ploy to make it seem as though she was still alive and throw investigators off his trail. In May 2013, Clay Starbuck's trial begins in Spokane. The prosecution points to Clay's troubled history with Shannon.
Basically, the case against Clay is that he's a jealous, kind of protective guy, and he would do whatever he had to do to keep somebody else from getting his ex-wife. Here's a guy that can't get what he wants. He's been kicked to the curb twice by Shannon, and it ain't gonna happen again.
Along with the video evidence that shows Clay lied and the DNA from the scene, it's a compelling case. But the defense counters that the evidence against Clay is inconclusive.
All along, the defense team for Clay Starbuck said, of course Clay's DNA is going to be on his ex-wife's body. Of course Clay's DNA is going to be on the home that he had once lived in.
And they suggest there's something the prosecution missed when they looked into Shannon's online relationships. By the end of the trial, Clay and Shannon's children have come round to his side, but Shannon's mother and her siblings are convinced of Clay's guilt.
We were told that you could never predict a jury. We were all nervous. Everyone was nervous.
On June 4th, 2013, the jury sides with the prosecution and Clay Starbuck is convicted of first-degree murder. When the verdict is read, Clay is stoic.
He had a very straight, stern face when the jury read the verdict.
Nobody deserves to be taken away from their kids, their mom, their life. She had a life. She was a good person. She would give you the shirt off her back if she could.
She was a wonderful person. She was a great mom. She always had the smile. Just seemed to brighten up the room. She glowed.